few weeks ago, I was privileged to serve as one of our congregation's delegates to the UU General Assembly, along with Barbara Gove and Joshua Goulet. Thanks to the wonders of the internet and the hard work of our General Assembly tech team, I joined UUs all over the country in participating in the work of GA from a distance, through a computer. This is the first year that people could participate fully from wherever they happened to be. Together with the delegates who traveled to New Orleans, we elected a new president of the UU Association, Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, the first woman ever elected to that position. We listened to reports of our denomination's leaders, passed a statement of conscience on the rising economic inequality in our country, and reflected over and over on our denomination's sometimes difficult history with race and the ongoing challenges of separating our theological identity from our white American habits of culture and making room for people of color in our membership and in our leadership. This was my first time as a delegate at a General Assembly, and it was marvelous and sometimes daunting to see the democratic process in action among such a large group of people. Keeping debate among hundreds of people, both fair and constructive, requires a lot of attention to process, sometimes more time spent on process than actually debating things. The result was both remarkable and sometimes bemusing. One measure proposed to change the sources from our list of principles of how we see the world and our list of sources from where we draw inspiration. We proposed to change the line that says that we draw inspiration from the words and deeds of prophetic women and men to say instead words and deeds of prophetic people, in recognition that not all people can be comfortably sorted into women or men. For that one word, we spent first an hour and a half in mini-assembly considering possible amendments. Was people or persons more appropriate here? Did we mean exclusively individuals, or should groups be included as well? It was noted that the change from men and women to people also could include children. We decided we were okay with that. We generated a half dozen possible amendments. And then at the end, we took a straw poll of the mini assembly and determined that we overwhelmingly preferred the original people. When it came time for the general session to actually consider and vote on the measure, it was so popular that no one came forward to speak against it at all. And eventually the moderator started dropping hints that if people would stop lining up to speak in favor of it, we could close the debate and actually vote it into action sooner. It did pass, with more than 80% in favor, enough to bypass the usual study commission process that can take years, and to instead bring it to a final vote at next year's General Assembly. As a person with a gender identity outside the usual binary myself, it's hard to put into words just what it felt like. To see, for starters, an amazing array of people who identify as genderqueer or non-binary or agender step up to the mic and say publicly, "This is who I am and this matters to me." And then to watch that assembly as a whole so overwhelmingly vote that it was worth the effort it took to make room for us. I'm willing to bet that many of those 80% plus of the people in the room didn't even fully understand what it's like to have a non-binary gender, or even what that means, really. Just as some of you may not, and I'm willing to talk about it sometime if you'd like to. And some of those delegates probably even harbored some skepticism about the whole idea of gender identity, much less the idea that someone's gender identity could be none or in between. But in that moment and in that assembly, they chose to make room anyway. Whatever their personal feeling about the theory may have been, they chose to make room. It was one of a number of actions that we took at General Assembly to be more inclusive, like encouraging the UUA's justice campaign, Standing on the Side of Love, to change its name to something that doesn't subtly identify righteousness with bodies that happen to be able to stand. And we recommended a study commission to explore adding an explicit reference to working against racism and oppression to our UU principles. We even considered changing the first principle from affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person to affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every being. Because why should we stop at humans? But ultimately, we tabled that one. It was easily the most controversial thing that came before us. And we tabled it at the suggestion of the very people who worked for years to get it on the agenda, because they felt that it was a distraction at a moment when our assembly clearly needed to be talking about race and the problematic dynamics of race and culture in our power structure. In all its mess and complexity, the work of this General Assembly made me feel proud to be a Unitarian Universalist. And also, I will tell you, in all honesty, there were a few moments when I looked at our agenda as a whole and watched our denomination's ultimate governing body spend hours of its once yearly meeting wrangling over small changes in wording, and more hours exploring over and over the contours of white supremacy, and there was a guilty little voice in my brain that said, "Is this all we talk about now?" Maybe you've heard that voice too. I've heard critics of our tradition claim that progressive politics have replaced God in UUism, that in the absence of a common holy book or a common shared image of the divine, we've turned to social justice as the glue that holds us together. I could just imagine their eyes rolling as they'd seen our plenary sessions this year. And sometimes, honestly, it seems like a hard charge to refute. We do talk about classism and racism and homophobia and transphobia and ableism and all the rest, the way the medieval church used to talk about the seven deadly sins. In many ways, oppression is now the devil of our religion, the source we name over and over for the evil and brokenness we see in the world. Of course, that's not a new focus for us. For hundreds of years, our Universalist and Unitarian forebearers have fought for social change. We fought for the abolition of slavery, for women's suffrage, civil rights, sanitation and health care, for prison reform, for marriage equality, for so much more. We also had several of the major leaders in the temperance movement that led to prohibition, thereby proving that liberal reformers aren't always on the right side of history. We've had our missteps. And we've also had moments of failing to live up to our ideals. But our central commitment to building a more just society is certainly as old as our faith. But I think it's also true that something has changed in the last few decades, even the last decade. The language we use is changing. Have you noticed that? Have you felt that? We talk now about marginalization, about colonization, of privilege and systematic oppression. We hear those words so often that I think sometimes they start to feel like they lose meaning. They almost start feeling like jargon. But I think they're also the act of us fumbling, of us trying to refocus the lens, to point to a different kind of understanding. Slowly, slowly, we have begun to see all these social ills that we have always fought as tied together in some fundamental, essential way, all part of a single pattern. We begin to see that poverty clings like a film to those whom society thinks of as other, that violence curls tight around those who are pushed to the margins of our society, and that those who have power and plenty somehow do not see those who do not, that those who have power and plenty come to think that they deserve it uniquely, that there could be no other way. So we're digging down. We dig down to try to find where the whole cycle starts. All of us together, not just UUs, but all over our society, activists, voices from everything from academia to the margins, we're working this problem. Thanks to the internet, we can hear each other in a way that we could not before. And as we dig down, many of us increasingly trace the roots of these evils, not to some grand malevolent conspiracy or some evil spirit, or even to intentional harm, but to the unquestioned assumptions of well-meaning people, to biases we all pass on from generation to generation without even knowing they're there. So much of the pain in our society traces back to a simple unease with the unfamiliar, combined with the kind of casual self-interest that seems universal, our human tendency to choose the slightly larger piece of cake, or to fear that somebody else is getting the bigger one. Such small things, but repeated over and over throughout a community, multiplied by millions of people, they can add up to tremendous harm. This is not just politics, progressive or otherwise. This is theological work. Slowly, stumblingly, we are redefining evil. And we are finding it bewilderingly ordinary. We are finding it not out there in the world somewhere, but close to home, even in ourselves. And I think there's another layer down that we maybe haven't talked about a lot yet, but that undergirds the whole. Something that points towards the heart of the human condition. And it's this truth, that we are both more separate and less separate from one another than we would like to believe. Less separate, in that we are permeable. We are built up of bits of one another's words and actions, infused with a teaching of culture that we breathe in like air without even knowing what we've taken in. Much as we like to see ourselves as self-made, the truth is that we cannot think through every problem. We cannot examine everything from the ground up. At some point, we have to trust one another. And we have to decide who we trust, whose account of reality we let in. And more separate from one another than we like to believe. In that our whole lives touch on only a tiny fraction of human experience, and that we can only know so much with our own senses. The inner lives of those around us, the particularities of their lives and circumstances, these are invisible to us, even if we walk alongside them for years, unless they choose to make those inner lives seen, and unless we choose to go looking. As H.G. Wells writes, "What a huge, inaccessible lumber room of thought and experience we amount to. How much we are, and how little we transmit." And so we learn that a white person can work beside a person of color for decades and never know how constantly they are told, subtly and overtly, that they are less worthy. An able-bodied person might never think to wonder what it feels like for a disabled person to constantly hear our shared life described as walking together, or to hear blindness and deafness used as metaphors for wrongness and fear. And people who are comfortable being called women or men might never even have reason to consider that someone might not be. And here I have to add a side note and an apology. Despite the themes in this sermon that I've said over and over, we just sang a hymn that said, "We're all brothers, sisters too." And in a few minutes, we're going to sing a hymn called "One More Step." Because these themes are so pervasive that it's hard to avoid without remaking the whole transition, rewriting all the songs. And we will do that. Just as we have over the last few decades, just since my childhood, largely rewritten all the songs and erased the masculine image of divine that used to be pervasive, saturated in our liturgy. But for now, it's still a work in progress. And so I apologize. We are made of one another. And we are fundamentally invisible to one another, unless we stretch ourselves out to see and to be seen. And as much as we might like to say, fine, we value every person, and be done with it, to say all lives matter, we are learning that it's not that easy. That we have to learn to see, learn to listen, and celebrate every facet of the human experience one by one. I invite you now to turn, if you're able, and sort of face in towards the center aisle. If you can kind of scoot in your seats. And let your eyes roam gently over the other people here. Not lingering too long, but taking in the other people in this room and this community. You might know some of them pretty well. Or maybe you don't. But whether you do or whether you don't, I promise you there are things about these people that you do not know. And we don't know. Perhaps there is someone in this room that you're each other. I know it's a little we don't do this. This is why I say don't stare at an individual. But let your eyes roll. Maybe there's someone in this room living with an invisible disability, living with a mental illness that they have never shared. Or perhaps there's someone here who has a gender identity that is not what you assumed it to be. Maybe until a few minutes ago that was me. Perhaps there's someone here whose cultural background is different from your own, but they've never shared it. Someone who carries a history
Maybe someone here is living with an abuser. Maybe someone here is rebuilding after losing one. Maybe someone here is struggling to survive working 3 jobs that would never tell you. We are learning more and more our own invisibility. And if they're not here right now, maybe one day they'll walk in the door. And we will likely never know it unless we learn to make space. Unless we learn to allow people to reveal themselves to one another, unless we learn to listen for those small barriers. Those words we use that we can always use, but that it turns out are hurting someone. So yeah, we talk about this a lot. But it's not because politics is at the center of who we are. It's because love is at the center of who we are when we are together. And because the work of this faith is learning to love better. Learning little by little what it means to love one another wholly. To make space for all that we are. It has always been the central work of religion to tend the poor and the downtrodden and the stranger. But now perhaps we are beginning to understand in a new way that if we would heal the hurt of this world, if we would welcome the stranger, we must be willing to open, to change what is comfortable, to make room for realities that we will never be able to verify with our own senses. And that's a form of faith. To make room for realities that we will never be able to verify with our own senses. But that we are willing to believe are real enough to be guided. Is the work of our faith. I invite you to rise now in body and spirit, and we'll sing that song, One More Step. It's number